Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. My special guest today is a playwright who has one of the finest, most honest plays that I have seen in years running at Northlight Theater, and his name is Bruce Graham. Hello, Bruce.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. Tell us about what got you to write this fantastic play, White Guy on the Bus.
Well, years ago, I'm always reading stuff to see if there's an idea somewhere. And years ago, I read an article about towns that had prisons, but no way for people to get there. Most people being related to prisoners, being below the poverty level, many of them didn't have automobiles, and how these people were trying to organize to get buses so they could go see their loved ones on Saturday or whatever the visiting day was. And that kind of stuck in my head. And then a few years later, I read an article about the Rikers Island prisoner bus. I'm sorry, bus to the prison. And so I went and wrote it. And it was quite an experience. So I did that a few times. And I got thinking, okay, every time I did it, I was the only, there were very few males to start with, it's mostly women. And I was each time the only white person on the bus. And I thought, okay, what if we put a white guy on this bus? And immediately the audience is going to say, what's he doing there? So automatically, hopefully, you have an unanswered question. And of course, I had to come up with the rest of the story. But it was started out with kind of this image and then proceeded to build the story around that image.
That's fantastic, because I would have thought that you started with the Frances Guinan character or the Mary Beth Fisher character, the couple.
Right.
So what was what was your purpose?
No, this was strictly my purpose. I'm sorry, you got cut off there. My purpose is always to entertain people. Okay, if people want to find, you know, what Aristotle calls the thought and all the theme or whatever, that's great, no extra charge. My first and foremost job as a playwright is to get you into the theater for 2 hours and entertain you. Sometimes, it depends from play to play. Outgoing Tide was a family drama with hopefully a lot of laughs in it. Stella and Lou, something very different, a small, tiny, little middle-aged love story. This one I knew was going to be a little edgier, but that's how it started out. My first job is to entertain you.
And you certainly do. Let's start out with your attachment to Chicago. You've now had three plays at Northlight, the world premieres, and you're a Philadelphia guy.
Actually, four.
Four?
Right. I actually had four. One 20-some years ago with B.J. Was in it. B.J. Jones, my director, was in the play. And 22 years later, they did Outgoing Tide. And from there, they did Stella and Lou, and now this one. So, yeah, it has become my second home, which is kind of interesting. For years, I never did a play anywhere but Philadelphia to start. And now they've done three premieres in a row.
So obviously you have quite a trust for BJ and the Northlight folks.
And I think that trust has been fulfilled. You know, they've done great work. A lot of theaters wouldn't take a chance on something like White Guy on the Bus. The subject matter scared them, and it took a lot of guts for him to do that.
It sure did, and I think it's paying off. The reviews have been fantastic on the show. To me, it's the most honest.
Tom, I don't read reviews.
You don't? Oh, you might want to read.
I stopped reviews 20 years. No, thanks. No. It's like a junkie or something. Once you stop, you can't go back. No.
You know, you're probably the only one I would believe to do it because of the honesty of your play. So let's talk about this play. I mean, it's unique about race relations. It's the most honest thing. Your black female character says it the way it is, and Frances Guinan's character says it the way it is. Tell us how you got to that. Because everyone plays political correct, and obviously you don't.
I loathe political correctness. I think it is an affront to the First Amendment in this country. No one's allowed to be offended anymore. You know, boo-hoo, too bad, toughen up. I like offending people sometimes. Now, in a play like Stella and Lou, of course not. That's a sweet little three-character romance. No. Here I knew I was going to offend people, and I kind of sat back and enjoyed the fact. We all go into this whole thing about, oh, we have to have an honest discussion about these things. We have to have an honest discussion about government or, you know, health care or race or religion. And no one wants to have an honest discussion. They just want to have their own, you know, point of view stroked. And the minute you come in with a different point of view, you're not welcome anymore. Honest, you know, intelligent discourse in this country, and if you don't believe me, look at Congress or the Senate, is down the tubes. It's everything's a soundbite, and God forbid you offend anyone. Well, guess what? King George was offended by John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and those guys, and that's how this country was founded. So, the political correctness thing really sticks in my craw. And whenever I see someone who comes out with this, I love baiting them, you know, because I'm in academia, I'm a professor, and I'm in theater, two of the most politically correct arenas there are in this country. And I don't fit into either of them sometimes, and I enjoy that.
That's fantastic. Well, you certainly, I mean, I just get blown away by it because I'm kind of outspoken that way too. And we have a number of people here, and it's just so refreshing to see the honesty in your play. So tell us how you come up with these characters. For the people who haven't been up the North Light to see your play yet.
And please go, because I'm on percentage. The characters are always some sort of extension of either me, someone I know, or someone I've studied. For me to write the part of a 26-year-old black woman, I better go do some studying. I better talk to some of my students, which I did. I had a couple of students who really helped me out with this. And then there's my own observation. I eavesdrop constantly. Because I make my students, the minute my students come in with their first day, I make them tape record a conversation and write it verbatim. That's how you learn how people speak. People always ask, well, which character are you? In this one, I'm Roz. I'm the cynical school teacher. I think she has some of the best lines in the play. And if I was a woman, I'd love to play that part.
And Mary Beth Fisher's fantastic.
And then I had to do some research just on, I'm quite happy. She nails every laugh without playing for a laugh. She plays it real. And Ray is a financier, and I don't know anything about that. I haven't written a check in years. My wife does all that. So I had to, like, do a little research on that end just so that he had the right points of view, the right expressions that he would use, and things of that nature. So I had to do a little research, and some of it just came from me. I usually base – it's so much easier. It's so much less work if you base your characters on people you know.
Well, you must have done a lot of research because one of the subtexts you dealt with is how big corporations know everything about us. and how those
unfortunately that didn't take a lot of research. That's pretty much out there. Yeah.
And so tell us about the academic character, the 26-year-old who's going for his PhD.
Right. This is actually very loosely based on our old neighbor. I had a daughter and he was quite a few years older, but he came over, I guess we moved in when he was like 8. And he'd be somebody I could have a catch with, and you know, I would take him out to dinner on his birthday, and you know, gave him his first hit off a cigar and things like that. I was a bad influence. And we're still friends. And I thought, okay, we have this couple, let's make them alone, you know? And how do we accentuate the fact that they're alone is, well, they have no kids, okay. But then you see them, their attachment to this kid who grew up next to them and used to hang at their house and swim in their pool and became their pseudo son. And I also kind of wanted to take my jabs at academia with its political correctness. So what do? I put somebody in there who's trying to get a PhD because that, to me, is a real game sometimes.
My younger reviewer, who's just out of academia, University of Illinois, he's so related to that character and to his dilemma because he has friends going for PhDs who have had that political correctness.
Oh, really?
He said, man, did you hit it right on the nose.
Great.
Yeah. But let's talk about the dynamic now without giving away that plot, because I don't think anyone has in their reviews so far, of what sets off the Francis Guinan character.
Good.
But Tell us the dynamic of that, because it's really honesty from the white point of view and honesty from the black point of view conflicting. You really nailed it. So tell us about that.
Well, you know, there's a certain truth, I hate to say it, to the expression, you know, a conservative is just a liberal who got mugged. You know? And that sometimes, you know, our point of view gets changed by things that occur to us in real life. There's a moment in the play when Christopher, the young guy, says something like, you know, these kinds of things don't happen to us. We read about them. And I think especially in neighborhoods like the one where they live, I did not grow up in a neighborhood like this by any stretch of the imagination, but I took some movie money when I was in my 30s and moved my family to a very nice neighborhood for my daughter to have the swimming pool and all that stuff. And I did not fit in, and I did not like it, and we now live back in South Philly. But so I had a taste of that neighborhood without actually, you know, having grown up in it. But that's the way people feel in those neighborhoods. We live out here. That crime happens, you know, 22 miles in that other neighborhood. Well, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes these things happen to people who don't expect them, and it changes their point of view. And I think that's what happens with Ray.
And it certainly happened to the young girl, the young teacher. She's the politically correct liberal until the dilemma happens until she gets pregnant.
Mm-hmm. Well, characters have to change. You know, that's one of Aristotle's rules that I do believe in. And usually you need at least one character to change. And in this, I was trying to see if I could kind of make every character be different at, you know, 9:50 when the show comes down, or if it's 7:30, 8:00, whichever it is. So that's important to me, is that to these characters. Otherwise, what's the point of spending 2 hours with these people if they end up the same way? You know, Kirk goes up at 7:30, comes down at 9:20, and they're the same.
Been there too many times, those kind of shows, yeah. But your show, mm-hmm. they certainly changed. But how did you, when you wrote the dialogue where the Frances Guinan character is attacking black people, and then the black girl is attacking the white people. I know it's accurate, but did you do any testing with your students on that to see how the reactions would go, the dynamic?
No, not really. I think once I got into the characters, sometimes once you get into the characters, they start to write themselves. That might sound a little cliche, but and I act everything out. My family has gotten used to me walking through the room playing 6 different people, and they just get out of my way. I'm down here at my Maryland house now finishing a script, and I do that just so I'm by myself, which helps. So, no, not really. I always overwrite early drafts. So Ray and Chateek and everybody had more to say. I mean, I knocked, I don't know how many minutes out of that play, because I really do think you have to overwrite early drafts, and cutting is easy. At least for me. Sometimes you use a scalpel, sometimes you use a machete, but there were scenes where I scalpeled and there were scenes where I macheted. So I would watch and see what worked, and I'd say, okay, I went too far, let's cut it right here. And BJ was, and the actors were great about going along with the changes.
So you worked right with them? Because it's a world premiere.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, I was only in the room the first 3 days, and then I go away. I've got one director friend of mine says I'm the closest thing to working with a dead playwright. I don't get in the room. I think I inhibit the actors, and frankly, I get really bored. So I come back to Philly, and then BJ and I talk just about every night, or I'd read the stage manager's reports, and then I make my changes and send them in. And then I went out for the first previews, and nothing teaches you like an audience. And suddenly I go, oh my, I said that how many times? Oh, and I can feel the audience kind of like, you know, twisting in their seats there. It's like, time to get out the machete. So by the time, I think from preview to opening night, we probably cut 4 minutes out of there, which doesn't sound like an eternity, but on stage it really is.
Yeah, that is. But let's go back to your writing process now. Do you, when you say you act them out, do you act them out before you write it down, or do you write down the words first?
I'm acting it out. It's a little bit of both.
Okay.
I will act it out and jot it down. That's what I usually do, especially scenes like a fight scene or scenes where people are excited, you know. If it's just leisurely dialogue, that's very different. I'm an actor. My training is as an actor. I've had my Equity card about 30 years. I just closed a show right before I went into rehearsal for this one back here in Philly. So I really believe that every playwright should be forced to go on stage. It makes them much kinder to the actors. I've been in plays where the author asks you to do something impossible emotionally and doesn't give you enough reason to do it, and I loathe that. So I just think, you know, to be a well-rounded playwright, you better, I'm not saying you got to, you know, hop on and be the next De Niro or, you know, do chorus work or something. Just go on stage and know what it's like. So I do act out everything. I think it really helps in the rewrite process.
Yeah. The only other writer I remember doing it was Rod Sterling from The Twilight Zone. He never wrote a word. He acted everything out.
Really?
And he had people take, like stenos, you know, stenographers taking down the words.
Oh. Oh, God, I could never have anybody in the room with me if I'm writing. No, it's, I don't even like the dog being in the room with me.
it's a totally solo for you. That's fantastic.
It is.
I read in one of your other interviews, you said every playwright should be a comic first, should have stand-up comedy training. Tell us about that.
I might have been misquoted on that, but it was great training for me. My training is not as a playwright. By the time I had one playwriting course, I was 28 years old and already had two plays off Broadway and one published. So, and even then I didn't show up half the time and I got a B, which I deserved. So I had a play in production. I couldn't go to class. So I'm totally self-trained. And when you're working as a comedian, and I worked with a partner, a guy named Billy Elmer, who's still a comedian in Pittsburgh. So we were writing, I was writing sketches. It wasn't just jokes. It wasn't just monologues. I was writing for characters. And we played a couple clubs on a regular basis and tried to come up with new material every week, just 5 minutes maybe. And so we'd do the 9 o'clock show, and I'd be on the corner of Forbes Avenue in Pittsburgh, you know, leaning against a dumpster, rewriting it for the midnight show. Well, they don't teach you that at Yale. So it was a great, great experience in knowing how to push an audience's buttons, what works, what doesn't. And, you know, there's nothing tougher in the world than comedy.
I agree. But that's great advice. So do you make your students do that?
No, but I do teach a class in stand-up at Drexel University. And it wasn't my idea. The students came to the head of my department and they asked if I would teach this class. And I teach it every year. And it's there's always a waiting list for it. It's kind of fun.
Have you
no papers to grade. I love it.
Have you produced any really big-time comics out of that class?
Not yet, but some who are working. Yeah.
Oh, that's going to make you feel good. So
it feels great. I can't wait to borrow money off them someplace.
I want to get into what kind of effects you want this play to do. How do you want to get the audience? I know you're trying to rile them up, and that's great.
Yeah, I mean this isn't the school of Dadaism, you know, where you try and get the audience angry, you know, by hitting them as they walk in the theater. But I'm so sick of plays, and I know one theater in particular in Philly that, oh, we want to inspire dialogue about certain things. Well, I can look at their season and go, okay, I see this point of view, I know this point of view, and it's always this predictable, very predictable point of view. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to kind of shake people up. And let's face it, you know, the average theater-going audience is older, is white, and tends to be politically, sometimes, more liberal. And it's so easy to go in and just, like, you know, attack conservatives. I want to attack liberals, too. I think I'm an equal opportunity offender.
You sure nailed everybody in this one.
Did I want to... Yeah. Oh, yeah, well, I did another play. I've done it with a few plays, actually. I have a play called Minor Demons, and this is back in the late 80s. And I came out of the theater in Philadelphia, and on the corner of 38th and Walnut was this elderly couple, like, screaming at each other about the play. You know, the husband taking one point of view, the wife taking the other. I just kind of skulked by and said, hey, that's pretty cool. You know, and then I went home and wrote a nice, clean comic for the next year. But it's great to get people, you know, discussing, talking, arguing. I mean, that's what sometimes, like I said, when the Stalin blew, nobody goes out arguing. You know, they probably forgot to play 10 minutes later about 11 o'clock, and they were entertained. It was nice evening, fine. This one, I think, is going to stick with you a little more.
Oh, yeah. BJ told me, I ran into him the other day. He said that he's averaging around 90 people for the talk back after every show, and he says it really gets feisty. He's proud of that.
Well, I did the first one, and then they kind of told me I didn't have to do any more because I was getting kind of feisty myself. I've been doing these things for over 30 years, and to be quite honest, I'm pretty tired of them. But I knew it's part of the deal, and I was kind of amazed, though, at some of the problems people have with the fight. I think it's a very Midwest thing. People in the Midwest are a lot nicer than we are on the East Coast. I'm talking New York, Boston, and Philadelphia.
Yeah, I discovered that when I lived in
Fort Lauderdale. We've got a real cynicism amongst our... Okay, all right. So
the New Yorkers in Philly would come down there. They're tough.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I'm just amazed at how nice people are in the Chicago area. In Wisconsin, I went to Lambeau Field wearing the Eagles hat, and people were nice to me, okay? I mean,
wow.
I got invited to tailgate. So, yeah, that would not happen in Philly. And so at the end of the play, Shatik has to make a decision. And I had some people saying, oh, I don't believe how she would make that decision. I said, you're an incredibly idealistic audience, okay, and you're Midwest. Because in Philly, they wouldn't be saying, oh, my God, she made a decision. They'd be saying, hey, ask for more money or something. You know,
right.
So I think it's geographically, I really do think some of the questions people have about the play, they're not going to have when it's done in New York or Philly or Boston, because we're all much more cynical. We say, yeah, of course you made that decision. And I think I got a little testy with some of the audience members. And
oh, I wish I was there. I love that stuff.
Which is when,
you know, I love seeing, I can see you can handle the audience between your knowledge of theater and writing and from those comic days. You really learned how to handle an audience when you did that stand-up, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's my strength as a teacher, I think. I was a high school teacher, and, you know, if you can handle a bunch of drunks in Pittsburgh on a Saturday night, homeroom doesn't look quite so bad.
Yeah, that's true. You taught in Chicago. One of the interviews I watched from you, you mentioned teaching in Chicago.
Oh, that was just a one-shot deal at the University of Chicago. I had a movie open out there that was took place a lot in Chicago. It was the Abbie Hoffman story called Steal This Movie. And they flew me out for the opening, and part of the deal was that I taught a class at the University of Chicago. So, no, I've never taught out there, just that one time.
Okay. And there's another quote I have to ask you about. You were talking about movies hate dialogue. And we have a lot of people that watch this podcast who are into writing, both, you know, for the stage and for theater. So can you elaborate on that a little bit for us?
Sure. That's actually from my play, According to Goldman. And the entire line is, movies hate dialogue. They're still pissed off about the Jolson's, the jazz singer out there. You know, that movies are visual and theater is dialogue. I was writing a play a year for a theater in Philadelphia, and then got into writing movies and was under contract to First Universal, then 20th Century Fox. At one point, I had two movies in production and a third in pre-production, and I didn't get to write a play for like 4 years. And it was driving me crazy. And when I finally did get a break to write a play, I wrote the play Coyote on a Fence, which Shattered Globe did years ago. And in fact, the local actor Steve Key, I believe, won the Jeff Award for it.
Yes, that's true.
In it, it's the most talk. Okay, but it's the most talky play I've ever done. It's two guys on death row. There's not a lot of action. A lot of it's letters. And I think it was because I was so sick of just writing car chases and things that I wanted to just write people talking. And it worked because it's one of my more successful plays. But I was so desperate to write some meaty dialogue that it was kind of my way of fighting back to my Hollywood stuff.
So beneath all this cynical stuff, you are an idealist.
I'm faking it because I'm being interviewed.
So tell us what's on your plate now. I mean, I said to BJ, this play, White Guy on the Bus, should win a Pulitzer.
Well, please tell them, okay? I don't think that's in the cards. Here in Philly, actually, next year I'll be at Northlight with a new play called Funny Man. And then in Philly, I was commissioned to write a play about our old mayor, Frank Rizzo, who was quite a character. So I've got that. And so far in Philly next year, I've got four productions. My old play, According to Goldman, the one we just quoted, is being done in a really nice theater called Act Two. And Stella and Lou is being done in a theater called People's Light with three friends of mine in it. Three old friends of mine are doing the three parts. And the director's an old friend of mine, so it's going to be old home week, and I can't wait. So I've got four productions in Philly next year. And of course, Funny Man is also being done in Philadelphia, and one in Chicago. And after that, who knows? I got to write the next play. I'm starting to get nervous.
You have to write one a year?
Sometimes I write two a year, actually. It depends.
Fantastic. Tell us what the future is going to be for you. Where are you going to be in 5 years?
According to my doctor, dead if I don't lay off some of the cholesterol. I have no idea. I'm writing for television now. I've been writing for a show for a couple of years, and I just started writing another one. My idea of retirement, I mean, I'm going to be 58 in a couple of years, so 5 years. My idea of retirement would be to act, teach, and write plays. At the moment, I'm acting, teaching, writing plays, and writing television. So I'll give up one of those and call myself retired. But I'll always do something, and for no other reason than my wife would kill me if I didn't.
That's fantastic. You obviously have a passion. So what advice would you give to students who are interested in being a writer?
Always have a backup plan, for one. I mean, I always had another job before I was able to support myself as a writer. Observe. Don't write about things you don't know. That's why I think there's not that much great science fiction literature. I mean, I think it's, unless, you know, very rarely are the characters interesting in there. The best things to me are the things that really feel real. And you also get your best material from them. I'm always telling my students, it doesn't feel textured. It feels generic. You know, go back, find out what these people are doing while they're talking. Give me their backgrounds. Remember, a character didn't come to life at 8 o'clock when they walked on stage. If the character's 42, you got 42 years worth of life experience before that character comes on stage. So to me, I think I've kind of made a career on observing and occasionally stealing. My best friends roll their eyes. They come to see my place. Hey, I said that. It's like, well, too bad you're not a writer.
Yeah. That is top-notch advice. You are a gem. And we hope all your plays get produced in Chicago. I mean, BJ can only do so many. I can't believe Steppenwolf or Goodman haven't done any of your plays. Or have they? I know you said Shattered Globe did one.
No, just Shattered Globe did a wonderful production of Coyote and a Friend. But no, not that I know of. I mean, that's between them and my agent, I guess. I stay out of it.
Oh, okay. Last thing, which is the hardest to write? Television, sure. Theater, or film?
Oh, theater. Because you're so limited in what you can do. I mean, you saw how the audience had to use their imagination in White Guy on the Bus.
Absolutely.
You know, we know that's not a real bus. You know, we're going from, you know, a house on the main line to an office, and all we're doing is moving chairs. You're very limited in how many characters you can have, how many costumes, your budget. I mean, in a movie, you know, I could have 4,000 characters and blow up you know, the Golden Gate Bridge if I wanted to. Can't do that in the theater. And television grinds it up, I mean, so quickly that unfortunately, unless you're on one of those HBO shows that only runs 8 episodes or something, the quality goes down. I mean, how many shows have you seen that start out the first 2-3 seasons are great, and then they go down the tubes? It's like making sausage. You're grinding.
Downton Abbey.
So I don't think the quality will be there, you know, just because of, you know, how many years can you do it? So the theater, to me, is the hardest one, and the least bang, okay? At least you have to pay a lot more.
But it seems like that's your passion. Would you agree with that?
Yep. Oh, I'm a theater person. Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at my schedule now to see if there's any plays I can audition for in Philly next year. You know, I've done 2 in the last, I guess, 8 months, 2 Neil Simons. I think I've done just about every Neil Simon play ever that ran for a month, Equity Theaters. And I love it. I love being on stage. That's my training. And I'm a character actor, so I'm the right age for this stuff now. I was never a leading man. So, but I have to look at my schedule first to make sure I'm not in Chicago with a play or somewhere else with a play, which is a great dilemma. I mean, I'm not complaining. I just, I hope I can do another show next season.
That's fantastic. I think that's the best advice you've given to young writers is get on stage with everything else.
Yeah.
Well, thanks. You've been fantastic, and we're going to do everything we can to get everyone out to see White Guys on the Bus. I know you have a little interest in that.
Well, thanks.
And I know you don't. You said you don't read reviews, but you'll be glad to hear that you're getting top reviews all the way around. And what the main thing they're saying about it is it's real and it's honest. And to me, that's one of the finest compliments you can get.
I agree with that. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for listening, folks. And thanks, Bruce. And we'll stay in touch. Keep writing. You're
okay. You're a terrific writer.
All right. Thanks for listening, folks. Bye-bye.